Welcome to Roundtable Talk, a podcast about longevity, senior services marketing, and the quality of life as one ages. Roundtable Talk is brought to you by Pavone Group and Varsity, a senior services agency focused on helping clients win the mature market. If you like the fresh perspectives we deliver in each episode, please give Roundtable Talk a 5-star review on the podcast service of your choice. Welcome back to Varsity's Roundtable Talk. Today's guest is a fun one. He's Joe Lancicero, a longtime Disney Imagineer who spent more than 3 decades designing some of the most immersive, story-driven environments in the world. At Disney, Joe helped shape attractions, retail spaces, and experiences that were designed to spark emotion, curiosity, and connection. In his post-Disney career, Joe has taken those same principles and applied them to industries like healthcare, reimagining how environments can reduce stress and improve how people experience care. Joe, welcome to Roundtable Talk.
Wow, thank you for having me today. I'm really excited to be able to spend some time and talk about all the wonderful things I've been able to do and you have interest in.
Absolutely. No, that's great. And it was fascinating as we were getting ready to go on how your one of your recent partnerships, projects, assignments, whatever you want to call it, is in Hershey, Pennsylvania, where I live.
It is. Yes. Working with the wonderful people at the Hershey organization.
Yeah, it's a great group. So you've spent your career designing environments that make people feel something. What did Disney teach you about how spaces shape emotion?
Wow, you know, I could go on. I could talk for literally for hours about that. But the most thing, you know, I always had to consider, or you always need to consider, is human-centered design. That no matter how someone, their age, their physical abilities, everybody comes into an experience with little different expectations. So firstly, and most importantly, you know, understanding the human condition, I think is number one, you know, that we hear, we smell, we see, we think, and then how, you know, just as we move through the world, how different lighting, spaces, colors, sounds, smells affect us. I mean, you could go deep into the psychology of, you know, how all that works. But when you're designing for, you know, a broad group of people the way we did, you have to work kind of at a higher level, you know, of a basic kind of human understanding. And then based on the kind of experience that we would be trying to create, then you could drill down and be more focused in it.
Sure. So what were some of the commonalities across the different you know, types? Because I'm sure at Disney you were obviously, you know, focused on the young, but really it's for all ages. Was there any different approach based on the target audience, or how did you create it for the masses, if you will?
A few different ways. First off, you know, and there, we always talk a lot about, you know, we're story driven, that there was always a story behind what we're doing. And I approach story, they're from two different angles. You know, often we used known IP, you know, characters, movies that people had seen. And when you're doing that, a lot of the heavy lifting is already done for you because people have seen the movie, they know the characters, the music triggers some kind of emotional response. So in those regards, then you're number one job is trying to make sure you're going to hit all those emotional trigger points that people remember from the films and the characters. And that's your immediate, you know, gateway into, you know, making sure that you're connecting emotionally with your audience. But then the second way I always talked about with my teams, when we weren't using a known IP, to still create some kind of backstory, or we call it a subtext story, that we as the design team would use as a measuring stick to make sure that we all agreed. It's kind of, I often use the analogy of like a musical score, you know, that, you know, all the musicians agree on this is the score that we're going to play and this is how we're going to play. And then me as the conductor making sure they understand the nuances of all that. But the end purpose of that was the same as using IP, and that was to make sure that we were creating things that people had some emotional touch point with, something that they were familiar with, something they had seen before, had heard about before. One of the things I learned when I was studying early on with the old Disney masters was about, you know, creating believable characters and believable situations. And even though, you know, the characters may be fantasy characters, they were hand-drawn, you still wanted to believe that they were really engaged in some human experience that, you know, that made you cry, made you feel. Walt Disney had the saying that, you know, behind every I always get it mixed up, but it's either behind every tear there's a smile or behind every smile there's a tear. And that was just his way of making sure he was exploring the breadth of human emotion. And that to me was always key in making sure whatever we did would resonate with people on some level.
That is really interesting. And, you know, I'm sure that, you know, Walt Disney's philosophy, his approach, you know, his essence still permeates the Disney organization. Not unlike what we were just talking about with Hershey, how Milton Hershey's spirit still is alive in, you know, all of the properties there in town.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, one of my mentors, at Disney was this gentleman, Marty Sklar. And, he was at one point the president of Imagineering. And he was actually Walt's speech writer, and had a long history with working directly with Walt. So I was fortunate, like with many of the other people I got to work with, I was of the generation that was kind of, we called ourselves, we were the handoff generation. We were the generation that didn't work directly with Walt, but were fortunate to work with all the people that worked directly with Walt. And Marty always talked about how Walt had one foot in the past and one foot in the future. And that foot in the past was always about many of the things that I was just talking about, understanding the human condition and understanding how those things that never change, you know, that who we are as human beings and what connects us as human beings. And that was usually grounded in story. So that was the foot in the past. The foot in the future was he was always forward looking in terms of, you know, what's the newest technology that I can use that's going to help me better, you know, connect with people and tell my stories clearer.
That's amazing. That's great. Thank you for that. So in a recent Ageist article, you said that great design creates emotional connection. And you're already alluding to that to a degree. What does that look like in everyday life, not just theme parks and those kinds of experiences?
Well, interesting you should ask. I recently co-authored a book. I'm going to plug it here.
Please.
Called Magic Moments, and it's how to intentionally engineer transformative experiences. And it's not a book about theme park design per se. A number of years back, I got involved with a group in Austria called the World Usability Congress. I try to keep the story short. I was still working at Disney at the time, and I was contacted by the head of the Congress, this gentleman, Hans Robier, who is my co-author of the book. And he asked me to give the keynote speech at his convention. He has a very large, it's one of the largest UX, user experience conventions in the world, actually. And it's a gathering of people from all different kinds of backgrounds, but with the common goal of focusing on human-centered design and creating user experiences that it's kind of lofty, but, you know, create better use of ease and elevate the human experience in some way when you're involved in whatever that experience might be. So he calls me and asks me, "Hey, Joe, I want you to come and give the keynote speech at my convention." I said, "Wow, Hannes, thank you so much. That's so kind of you. I appreciate that. But I have one question for you. What's UX?" It was a whole industry I was not aware.
Sure.
And he said, "Well, Joe, it's what you've been doing your entire career at Disney, and that's creating experiences for people, you know? and especially people experiences that resonate emotionally. So I went and I gave the keynote speech. It was very well received, and I was invited back again and again and again. And now, almost 10 years later, I've been not only speaking at that conference, but because that opened up this whole other world of opportunities for me to take those lessons that I learned at Disney, creating rides and attractions and theme parks and understanding how people interact with those kinds of experience, but then apply them in a whole new realm of things and not necessarily an industry. And that's getting back to our book. Our book, it's focus, as it says here, on business life and private life, because we believe if you understand, you know, the human condition and how to think about, you know, the way people respond to and react to certain situations, that you can create a deeper situation, a deeper understanding, a deeper, whether it's a birthday party, you know, doing something special for your kids, for your wife, planning a dinner for your friends, a business dinner, a vacation, you know, taking these principles of this, I don't want to say the story part of it, but there, you can, again, like I was talking earlier with this, creating backstories. You know, understanding, like, oh, you have three friends, and each of them come from, we all went to college together, and I remember we enjoyed this fraternity thing, blah, blah, blah. And so you can build a story around that, and then while you're doing that, you're understanding, you're getting deeper into, you know, these are that's what connected us, that's what we like. And then with that understanding, that knowledge, you can build an experience, you know, that's going to be deeper and more resonant.
That's wonderful. I love that. And, you know, it is so important that we have spaces and places and opportunities to connect. You know, I mean, that's one of the things that, you know, we know, particularly as we age, how important, you know, socialization is and how detrimental social isolation is. So yeah, it's great to be able to kind of bring that to life in a special way.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure you're familiar with the blue zones, those where they talk about those places, you know, on the planet where, you know, people live to 100+, and, you know, and one of the commonalities with all of them is that sense of community, that they all feel like they belong to something bigger than them. And it could be a religious thing, it could be a social thing, but it's something that connects them to something bigger than just them.
That's wonderful. Yeah, we just had Dan Buettner Jr. on a recent conversation, and it was fascinating to hear him talk about you know, the genesis of it and how it's evolving over time. The concept
fantastic.
Of blue zones.
That's fantastic. Yeah,
but interesting. So, are there simple environmental changes either at home or in senior living communities, wherever older adults might be living, that could be meaningful to improve how people experience getting older or aging?
You know. You know, there are of course physical things. You know, when we have a of course the ADA guidelines that we had to use at Disney to make sure, you know, wheelchair ramps and all that. But there's a principle called universal design that I talk about a lot in my speeches to the UX groups, and it was developed by an architect, and unfortunately his name is eluding me right now. But the philosophy was when you think about designing for the oldest person and the youngest person, you're going to create good design, because it's going to be design that considers, you know, both physical limitations and capabilities, and how people understand it and interact with design. And actually, the first time I heard about it years ago, I was invited to speak at a conference with the Royal Academy of Art in London. And the theme of the conference was designing for our future selves. And there were college students. And
I love
so,
that.
You know, and when you're 20 years old, you don't think about what it's going to be like when you're 60, 70, 80 years old. And so they were there, all of their design assignments was, you're designing a new, a sink, something as simple as a sink. How would that sink work better when you're this age? And it was there that I became aware of universal design and how if I think about, and now as I'm aging, and I'm noticing things like, how you open a package, how easy is it to open or not to open? No. And if the designer was thinking, a very young hand is going to have a hard time opening it. A very old hand might have a hard time opening it. How can I better design that to make it more easy? There's a wonderful design company called OXO.
Sure, yeah. We have a lot of their household kind of gadgets, yeah, and things.
Yeah, and I believe the gentleman's name was William Farber, and he, his wife had pretty debilitating arthritis. And so he noticed her in the kitchen trying to peel, use the peeler, and she couldn't get a good grip on it. So he created that now very, very famous grip handle that's a part of all their design. And if you look up there on their website, they have a wonderful picture of their offices in, I believe it's in New York. And one whole wall is covered with gloves that they have collected from the streets of New York. Tiny ones from little children, big ones from adults. And the whole purpose is a reminder that we are designing for all those hands.
Interesting.
Yeah.
What a great visual representation.
Yeah. And a great reminder every day when you walk into the office that that's our mission.
That's right.
That's what we're here for. Yeah.
That's right. And as you were talking, it reminded me of a phrase that I'd heard. I'm a fan of Frank Lloyd Wright's work, at least, aesthetically. I think from when he worked with or studied under Louis Sullivan, form follows function, and that whole sense that, there's the design functionality, but then there's the design from an aesthetic, a beauty perspective. And I think I love when those two things can come together.
And they should. Yeah. And they should never be exclusive of each other, I think it goes back to this concept of universal design, because I believe simple design is elegant design. And if you look at like what OXO does with their design, I mean, there's many designers out there right now whose work I love. I love Dyson, the work that Dyson does. Same thing. There's a huge functionality aspect to it, but there's also a beautiful aesthetic part to it as well.
Absolutely. No, that's well said. We know that good design helps, but do we underestimate how much bad design contributes to stress, confusion, or even isolation in people of any age?
Yeah. I'm just going to continue on this universal design theme for a little while. Yeah. And one of the main principles, again, at our UX conference is about human-centered design and understanding, people's capabilities, and that not everybody comes to an experience with the same understanding. Yeah. I did a talk once, and it was 1 year. They give out an award every year, to the best speech. And that particular year, I got the award.
That's great.
And it was on... I called it floaters, swimmers, and divers. And it's not a phrase that I came up with, but I kind of expanded on it. We used it at Disney. And that's understanding that that everybody comes to an experience with a different level of expectation and understanding. The floaters are those people that might have a rudimentary interest in whatever the subject might be, if it's a Disney IP or it's going on a cruise ship or whatever. Those are the floaters. The swimmers are those people that, are a little more engaged. They've, maybe they've read about this experience and, they want to, and they may spend a little time on the internet, looking it up and, getting a little deeper into it. And then there's the divers. And the divers are those people that, know everything there is to know about that subject matter, absolutely love it, are totally engaged in it. But understanding that you have to design for all those people. And when getting back to this idea about bad design can be either when you assume that everybody knows about what you're doing. There's a great principle. There's a book called Made to Stick by the Heath brothers. They've done a number of books, great books on ideation and why certain principles stick and why others don't. And they talk about the curse of knowledge. And the curse of knowledge is the idea or the thought that everybody, when you mention, like I would be in a meeting at Disney and I mention, okay, we're gonna do an attraction with a red dog. Okay. If I went around that table, everybody at that table probably is thinking, okay, is it like Clifford the Big Red Dog, or is it a golden retriever that looks red, or is it a tiny little? Because we all, you know, we hear words and we all think everybody else is thinking the same thing we do. That's why it was always important to get some kind of design down that we can all look at and say, okay, that's the red dog. So then there's in the Heath Brothers book, they talk about this this little game you can play to understand, you know, to bring it more to life. And they say you stand across or sit across the table from somebody and say you're going to tap out on the table a song that everybody in the world knows. Everybody's got to know this, and they'll start tapping. Okay, what song is that? 9 times out of 10, the other person on the other side, they have no idea. Well, what was that? Well, of course, I was tapping Happy Birthday to You because you think everybody would know that. But it plays up that point that we're, you know, you can say words, but we're not all thinking the same thing.
Yep.
So again, bringing this full circle back to your question about bad design. For me, bad design is when you haven't done the hard work of understanding how your audience, your guest, your user is really going to engage this, what they're coming with, what you have to provide them with, and then getting back that universal design, trying to strip it down to its simplest, the most simple core design elements, story elements, and then once you've got that, then you can start layering on top of that, you know, for the swimmers, for the divers. But if you don't start from that core place, you know, you're going to end up with bad design.
Sure. That makes perfect sense. So you've taken those principles from Disney, storytelling, immersion, sensory cues, all of those aspects, and applied them to healthcare. What does that actually look like in practice?
You know, I was... there's a group called Healthcare by Design. There's a few different groups. And actually, and this goes back to the World Usability Congress. This woman, Miriam Waters, she is one of the chief designers for Philips Electronics in Eindhoven, Holland. And she came and spoke at the conference and gave this great talk about, initially it was specifically about the designs of hospitals and medical situations. But we ended up having a great conversation again afterwards about, you know, some of the things that they were working on and she was thinking about. And so that got me involved with, you know, working with her and talking more about this whole idea. And in fact, she in our book again, she does a wonderful case study in here about emergency rooms, you know, and emergency room designs. And again, how the difference when a little child comes into an emergency room versus an older person, you know, everybody comes in with different levels of needs. There's just so much to consider. And how at the highest level, you know, right now, so much of healthcare is about the function. And it has to be. It has to be, because that's, you know, first and foremost, it's about, you know, caring for that immediate need of the patient. But that doesn't mean you can't start, you know, thinking about other ways or of creating the physical environment. First off, I am a big advocate of lighting and the effect that lighting has on people. In hospitals, of course, and in many industrial spaces, you know, you have to think about the task light. You know, you have to see. It's important for those people that are working to be able to see. And even in our Disney attractions, you know, there were places where it was important for safety reasons that we had to have lighting at a certain level, you know, to make sure people didn't trip or they could easily access, know where the door is, those kinds of things. But that doesn't mean you can't create, you know, pockets, little puddles, moments of lighting that bring the situation down, you know, warming it up, lowering the lighting level. So one of the things she talks about in her case study, you know, is understanding the different aspects of the medical experience and where the light needs to be up and where the light needs to be down. And it's a simple thing, and it's a very simple thing, and it can, and very much changes the way people feel about it. The other thing is sound, especially for little kids. I've got grandkids, and I know, like, you know, big noises scare them. And for some of us, as we get older, you know, we're not hearing as well as we used to. Understanding the soundscape, and again, where it's important for people to be able to hear information, either over a PA or the sound level being at a level so that there can be easy conversation. But if you can, you know, think about where can you mask out the noise? Where can you add some music? And you know, music was always a huge part of everything we did at Disney. You know, getting back to this, you know, emotional connection piece, and how, you know, a piece of music can immediately, and everyone knows this, you hear a song from when you were 16 years old and you're taken back to that moment. You know, you remember you're sitting in the car with your friends, or you're on vacation with your parents. I mean, it's such a powerful thing. So if you understand, you know, where to put the music, when to use the music, again, sometimes it's subliminal, you know, it's like elevator music, but it could be used again. And this, I'm taking this back then to the healthcare piece, you know, to mask the noises in a hospital, which can be harsh. And again, where you use them, you know, once you're in a waiting area and you don't need to have harsh task light, you can bring the lighting down, you can create a softer user experience. And all this is about, you know, of course, reducing stress. And we all know that most medical experiences are stress inducing on some level. There's some level of anxiety by either you are in the moment, you're in some kind of pain or worried about what's going on in your body. And so anything we can do, the music, the lighting, to bring that stress level down. And they're very simple tools, you know?
That's great. Interesting. So what's broken about the typical healthcare experience today from a design perspective? I realize it's the antithesis of what you've been describing, but.
Well, because I think it's all task focused currently. Or a lot of it, because there's a lot of good work, you know, being done. And unfortunately, and I think more so in America, you know, a lot of it has to do with economics, you know, especially during COVID. Oh my gosh, we heard all the horror stories, you know, sure, of understaffed, you know, not enough people. I mean, and their number one concern, of course, is taking care of the people there. You know, they're not thinking about, you know, how are we going to create a more aesthetic, you know, calming, less stressed situation when, you know, there's three people trying to take care of 25 people. So I think, you know, part of the problem is, you know, the funding, the understaffing, you know, just the healthcare system in general and the way it works. So, but there's the good news is there is a lot of thought and are a lot of people out there thinking about, talking about, and trying to make a difference.
Well, that's great. And I'm sure at some point it's just acknowledging that it's not just about the functionality. It's not just about the task, as you say. Acknowledging that, I think that is such a maybe an aha moment, at least in our conversation. You're just people recognizing that it can be better,
yeah,
and design can help it be better. So
absolutely
interesting. So you've talked about designing the journey that a patient goes through. How does that experience begin? Is it the first Google search that they make, the appointment booking, the waiting room? And where do you see the biggest missed opportunities to reduce stress and create a better experience?
You know, I think it's going to be a long process to get to that point, because just what you explained, it is a journey now. You know, at some point you realize you need to, you know, make an appointment. Unfortunately, there's less and less human interaction happening. With so many systems now, it's all automated. You call up, you know, especially with AI, you're talking to a chat box or chat robot, you know. And I am a huge advocate of the human, like I said, human-centered design, and that means getting more human touch points into the experience from the very start. And that's not to say we have to completely disregard the technology, but I think we need to think about the technology and think about it as, you know, a human thing, that it's a human to human experience, not a machine to human experience. I think if the journey starts there, with people immediately feeling like people want to feel like they're being listened to. People want to feel like, you know, that person on the other end of the line, and even if it's a machine, kind of cares for me, you know, and understands that this is stressful. This is, you know, I'm going through something that's, you know, that's difficult this moment. So I think once you set that tone at the beginning of the journey, and then let that lead through the rest of the journey, and it's so complicated. And honestly, I don't have it all figured out. I don't know if anyone has it all figured out yet. But like you said a moment ago, I think the start is acknowledgement. You know, that we're acknowledging that there's broken pieces of the system, and there's things that we need to fix. And now once we get to that point of acknowledgement and understanding that there are tools that we can use, then that brings hope to me. I have hope that then we can, you know, can change it.
That's great. So from a patient's perspective, where would the experience of healthcare feel noticeably different if it were designed like a Disney experience? I mean, you've been talking a bit about some of the best practices through your lens, but yeah, if it were truly designed as that, how would it be different?
You know, the Disney experience is based on, you know, and the reason why people come back to the Disney experience time and time again. I feel like one of the highest rated Disney experiences of the various things that I worked on were the cruise ships. And the cruise ships are a combination of a physical thing, the ship itself. But I think more than the parks, because in the parks, I said there was short form experiences and long form experiences. When you go to a park, you're in the park for, you know, 8 hours, 12 hours. On the cruise ship, you're there for days. So there was a different kind of approach to how the operators, the cast members, would interact with the guests. And so that the interaction, the time they spent, you know, and the way they thought about dealing with the guests were a little different. And you know, I'm going to apologize for a second because I lost my train of thought and the focus of your question.
No, it was just how would healthcare feel noticeably different if it were designed more like a Disney experience?
Oh, cool. So, okay, I'm so sorry.
Yeah. So it was all tracking.
Yeah. So I think when we designed the cruise experiences, we thought about the again all the things I've been talking about, but the overall journey, you know, that it's understanding that, you know, the guest is going to be here for a certain amount of days, you know, they're going to be with their family, they're going to be doing all these things, and of course it was stories. There was all the stories that were kind of connecting it together, you know, and again understanding how to modulate those stories over the course of the number of days that they're going to be there. So I think there's parallels there that, you know, can be applied to, you know, again thinking about that. If we think about the patient going on a journey and understanding what they're going through, understanding, like I said earlier, some people, you know, come to, you know, they've pre-diagnosed themselves. They've gone online. Sure. Yep. They've done a bunch of research. Others come in with, you know, more trust in the system. And, but it's understanding that, you know, that they're all on that same journey, you know,
sure.
And trying to understand then, you know, what are all those tools that I've been talking about, you know, reducing stress, clear communication, the understanding of that everybody doesn't understand the same things, all those things come into play. And I would think about, you know, often on the cruise line, how a lot of the dads didn't want to be there, you know. Yeah, but we still had to create moments for them as well as for the children. And again, I'm rambling on a little bit, but it all just comes back to putting the time and effort into really understanding and thinking about, you know, each individual, you know, and how to create a journey that satisfies, you know, everybody, but also that single person.
And that is true, because there is a lot. I mean, you know, in our work, when we get into marketing and advertising, it is about understanding some of those core human truths. Like you said, what is the child expecting? What is, you know, the dad expecting or not expecting, and how can we, you know, surprise and delight each of those folks with an experience that will make it meaningful. So no, it makes perfect sense. So this is a question that every Roundtable Talk guest gets. What are you looking forward to as you age?
Well, first off, I don't want to. Yeah, we slow down. I mean, there's no denying that, you know, you can't stop aging, the physical things. But I think I don't want to lose, and I try not to lose my sense of curiosity. I think I've been very fortunate. When I worked for Disney, I got to travel quite a bit, and now since I'm on my own, I split my time between LA, Los Angeles, and Madrid, Spain, because my wife is European and wanted to have a home base there. And we do a lot of traveling. And the thing I enjoy most about traveling is learning new things. Every adventure, no matter where you go. Some friends invited us to Mexico City for Easter, and it was wonderful. They took us. The one lady lives there, or her family lives there rather. Introduced us to some new foods. Introduced us to some new traditions that she and her family had done, then of course, especially now with, you know, this thing in your pocket and all the information everywhere you go, I was Googling this and, you know, and asking Siri about that. And I think that just being engaged, and I think it keeps you young, you know, and it keeps you fresh. And having the time to do that, we spoke a little earlier how back when I was working, you know, and in charge of all these things at Disney, you know, somebody else controlled my time. But now that I can control my own time, I think I want to take the time to be able to dive a little deeper, to slow down, to, you know, notice the wonder again in the world.
Yeah, when, that's great.
As little children, you know, the world is filled with wonder. And then as we become older and older and all the responsibilities and everything comes, the world becomes less wonderful. And I think it's almost nice. I'm kind of going back to my childhood in a way, in being able to take the time to see the wonder in the world once again.
That's remarkable. And you know, it's apparent that you're just a curious individual, which that's obviously a compliment. I mean, I hope you take it as such, but I'm sure that's why you've been successful at what you do, but also having that, that sense of adventure in your own personal life. You know, I can see where that really, you know, adds to it. So staying engaged later in life is a common theme discussed, here on Roundtable Talk with our various guests. After decades at Disney, you didn't slow down. You pivoted into new creative work. What drove that transition?
As I mentioned earlier, I have to thank the World Usability Congress, you know, just stepping into that world and realizing that I had amassed all this experience and all this knowledge, that I thought I was just applying in one way, and understanding that, you know, this idea of human-centered design, that, you know, we're all human. We all go through this life with, you know, with the same, basically. And that's another big learning from travel. You know, nothing opens your mind to the fact that we're all alike than traveling. Sure, there's cultural differences. There's, you know, geographical differences that come into play. But we all laugh when we hear something funny. We cry when there's something sad. I mean, it's just, you know, being human. I'm losing my train of thought. I'm so sorry.
No, that's right. Just that you've, you know, what drove the transition into, you know, into the new type of creative work?
Sure. So it was back to that. And then, it was rewarding because, I had a lot of fun and learned a lot at Disney, but I also did it for a long time. And it was sure nice to be able to now to engage with other people, and realize that these things, you know, could affect them, you know, in a completely different industry or in a completely different situation, and be as impactful as what I had done when I was designing the work for the theme parks. And again, getting back to my book, that's a lot of what this is about.
Sure. No, that's great. That's great. And we will be sure to put a link to that in the when we do post the podcast. So thank you for that.
Great. Thank you.
So how has your relationship to creativity changed as you've gotten older? I mean, you've kept that spirit, that spark of of curiosity, but how has your relationship to creativity changed?
I don't think it has. I'm very blessed. I'm very fortunate in that I never chose to be a creative. It wasn't a choice, really. As far back as I can remember, I loved to draw and build things and dream and come up with stories, and it's just a part of who I am. And fortunately, now that I have more time, I'm enjoying kind of tapping back into that in a pure form, because I'm not being, I don't have a deadline. I don't have to, you know, have a big corporation that needs a return on their investment and all those things. I can, you know, Disney was a great creative outlet, but of course, you know, it had not limitations, but, you know, you had to be realistic about the fact that you're working for this big company. Now I can just play more. I carry a sketchbook with me all the time, and I'm constantly documenting my travels with little sketches. If anyone follows me on any of my socials, that's probably the number one thing I post, are the sketches from my travel. And for me, that's kind of the purest expression of my creativity these days.
Wonderful. So what advice would you give to someone who feels like they're past their prime, either creatively or professionally?
Take a walk in the woods. you know, go to the opera. Read a great book. I mean, the world is filled with so much wonder, you know, and often we, and age shouldn't play into, you know, your ability to tap into that. You know, like as we've been talking, there are physical limitations that come with aging, but all that's still there. I think it's just a question of, you know, opening your eyes, opening your mind, and embracing this life. There's so many wonderful things out there for us to enjoy.
Yep. Wonderful. So when you look at the most meaningful experiences that you've helped create, what do they all have in common?
What we've been talking about for almost the last hour. And I think that's, you know, tapping into the human experience, understanding that, you know, we laugh, we cry, we enjoy being together, and always trying to find, and humor was also always a big part of what I did. And this can be a pretty harsh experience, this life, you know, especially these days. You know, we're going through some kind of dark time. So I always tried to, not to gloss over reality, but, you know, take a moment, maybe sometimes put up a mirror, show the absurdity of a moment, you know, just so help us laugh at things, and really see, you know, that there's always a brighter side to things.
Absolutely. I was just talking to a friend today about the state of the world, and you know, it is important to try to remain positive when possible. So
absolutely.
So, you know, we've been talking a lot about the time, the more than three decades that you spent at Disney as an Imagineer. What was the moment or moments when you said, "I can't believe this is my job"? I'm sure you must have had some of those moments.
There were so many. I was so fortunate, and you know, now I have the luxury of being able to look back, and often, you know, and most people, you know, when you're in the moment of doing something, you know, you're very focused, you know, and I took my job very seriously, even though it was a fun job. And like I mentioned, you know, I knew I was also working for a big corporation, and I had to be responsible to the shareholders, and, you know, and to my seniors, and, you know, making sure that, you know, things were done, you know, on budget and on time and all that. And so, you know, often you didn't have a moment to step back and really look at it. But there was always that moment I would allow myself, and that was once we finished something and being able to step back and watch the guests either coming off the ride or walking through the cruise ship or standing in the hotel lobby or whatever it was, and just being able to savor that moment of seeing their faces, that I was so privileged to be able to create something that
That's
was
amazing.
Giving them a wonderful moment.
I love that. And I'm sure it had to be rewarding. And I'm sure it was something that you just wanted to bottle and hold on to. But
absolutely.
That's great. So people think of Disney as fun and whimsical. We've been talking about some of the fun side of it. And you've also talked about how it's still commerce, right? It's still, you know, a company with objectives and shareholders to please. But What might be something surprising about how rigorous or disciplined the process actually is?
I'm gonna go back to that quote from Marty Sklar, you know, from Walt Disney about, you know, knowing that, you know, they have, the company has this deep tradition, you know, that foot in the past, you know, that an expectation, you know, about fairy tales and happily ever afters and all those story things that kind of are consistent and are very much in line with all I've spoken about the human condition. But I love the fact that they're continually moving forward with, you know, acquisitions that bring new characters and new stories in, you know, looking at, you know, technologies that are going to make, you know, the storytelling stronger, more believable. That's very serious business, you know, but in the end, to the guests, and this is something I always thought about, they should not be aware of all that. They should just like all these design things we've been talking about today, whether it's in a hospital situation, on a cruise ship, whatever it might be, the experience should just be unfolding, you know, in a way that they feel it's meeting an expectation, it's creating a memory, it's touching them emotionally in some way, and it's all happening without them aware of all that's working underneath it to create that.
That's great. And just kind of let themselves be carried away by the experience.
Yes, absolutely.
That's great. You know, I think it's amazing that you've been involved in when I think of someone who is a Disney Imagineer, if I can use that title, that, you know, getting involved with healthcare and some of the other things that are kind of incongruous with that fun experience. And it was interesting. We had on a recent episode, Jerry Mitchell, who is a Broadway choreographer and director, and he was talking about how he was hired by JetBlue to help them think about the choreography of moving through their new terminal. And I just think it's fascinating how you can have, put two things together. I guess that's what creativity is, right? Putting two things together that really don't seem related, but finding something special in the process.
Yeah, and I think that's a great example. And I think I've been fortunate to do that too, that I think often looking out, and I actually did this at Disney too, you know, looking outside of the immediate expected circle of experts, you know, that spend all their days thinking about that particular thing, and bringing in somebody with a different point of view, not necessarily a different point of view, but a different perspective that they're bringing, but with the same understanding of the objective that you're trying to work towards.
Sure. Interesting. Now, I'm curious. There's a lot of conversation in our field and just in society in general about AI and the impact and the opportunity. Obviously, Disney had they had a partnership that they were moving forward with I believe it was OpenAI, that may or may not go forward. I'm not going to ask you to comment on that in particular, but just curious, as someone who has really built your career on ideas and creativity, what are your thoughts about the long-term impact of AI and how it can either enhance or detract from the human experience?
I'm not deeply into using AI, although I do. And actually, because we had a few different people with using different languages, because we have these case studies, we used AI to help combine ideas and put it all into a single language for us. So it was a great tool. At least my understanding right now, AI only knows everything that's out there right now and can gather, you know, can quickly gather information for you and give it to you. the experience that's happening right now between you and I, there's a human connection that's happening when you're exchanging ideas with another human being. That has a fluidity to it and a spontaneity to it. And I think, at least my current experience with AI is that it's a very controlled exchange of ideas, or not even exchange of ideas, of putting forth
kind of collecting what's out there and formulating it. Yep.
So, I want to believe that, you know, that friction that happens when you're engaged with another human being, when you're engaged in a situation, I don't know if that's necessarily something that a machine can have. Who knows where it's going to go. But for me right now, it's a great tool to help me gather information, put information together, but it doesn't take the place of what's happening right now. And that's, an exchange with another thinking person that has emotion and experiences too. The AI, their experience is just based on all these layers of knowledge that's out there on the internet. It's so great being with groups of people, and why we enjoyed getting back what we were talking about earlier about, these people that live to, 100 years old, and they go, well, why is that? Because they're involved in a community of other like-minded people, or they're involved in a religious group, or they're involved in, they go to a choir, that human interaction, I think, is the thing that I hope, could never be replaced by AI.
Makes perfect sense. So before we get to the last question, I'm curious, what are some of your favorite experiences that you've had? Some of the favorite experiences that you've designed for Disney or anybody else? Just talk a little about that. Would love to hear from your storied career, what are some of the things that you're either most proud of or, that really stick with you?
Oh man, again, we could talk for hours on that. I guess because I was very, very blessed to have a lot of wonderful opportunities. That's kind of like asking, if you have three kids, which one's your favorite kid? You love them all for different reasons.
And that's fair. So maybe it's not even your favorite, but just one or two that stick out to you.
When I was very fortunate early in my career to design a new land for Disneyland, it was the Mickey's Toontown. And I think that was very impactful because it was early on in my career. I learned a lot doing it. Again, at the time, I didn't understand I knew I was being given an incredible opportunity. To design a whole land for Disneyland, especially a place where, Mickey Mouse was going to live, right. The corporate icon. And I think back on that and,
I'm sure that was special for many reasons.
Yeah. And then getting involved, I was fortunate because I got to be involved in a lot of firsts or kind of newer endeavors, working on the cruise ships, because I worked on the very, very early design of when Disney first decided to get into the cruise business, and having to think about, how we were going to infuse the brand into that existing industry and how we wanted to create a new type of cruising experience for the family, because it didn't exist at the time. That was fun. And, and I think the other wonderful aspect to my career was working with different cultures. We've talked about the advantages that travel bring in terms of opening your mind, and I first started working early in my career in Japan, and having to understand, the differences, again, those things that make us alike and those things, the differences, the cultural differences. And then I worked in China, and again, you know, at first I felt, wow, I'm in Asia, you know, it should be like Japan. Well, no, it's not.
I bet that is an important lesson to learn and then apply to the work that you're doing.
Yeah. And then working in Europe, when we were building the cruise ships in Germany, and understanding, you know, it was interesting that there were a lot of parallels between the Japanese work ethic and the German work ethic, you know, and, you know, very, being very organized and punctual people, and, you know, and doing, you know, delivering when they said they were going to deliver. And, but that was, I think, a wonderful gift for me to be able to, you know, to work with so many diverse, different types of thinkers in different places, you know, who brought their points of view and their understandings to what we did. And that's what made it richer in the end.
That's great. That's wonderful. Well, it's been just a delight to talk with you. I do have one last question. What have you learned that you wish you could have told your younger self?
This one I've thought about before. To trust the process. You know, that it's when you're involved in these big projects, or I would say big and small projects, and because no man is an island, we always are working with somebody else on some level, sometimes a big team, sometimes small teams, maybe just with another person, and allowing the process to flow, that that all of us is better than one of us. And you know, when you're young, you're ambitious, you can be, you know, a little myopic. And I would go back and I would tell my younger self, you know, Joe, just ease off a little bit and enjoy the process, and let the process unfold.
Wise words. Well, thank you so much. Our guest today has been Joe Lancisero, author of Magic Moments and a longtime Disney Imagineer and creative fellow and all-around good guy. And I look forward to the next time you're in Hershey and we can grab some sort of a chocolate-themed lunch at one of the local eateries.
Okay, and there are plenty to enjoy there for sure. I look forward to it very much. So.
Absolutely.
And thank you for having me on the show today. I really, really enjoyed our conversation.
It's been a lot of fun. And thanks also to Dave Schaffner, our producer, and Matt Campbell, our engineer. I'm Derek Dunham, and we'll see you next time on Varsity's Roundtable Talk.
Thanks, Derek. Bye-bye.
Bye.